Do you like to get things done? Do you make lists and then have more lists and more lists and suddenly you don't know where your lists were? Have you tried using a bullet journal or a day planner to keep track of all of this? If that's you, and you've always just kind of felt there was a piece missing, that there was something lacking, that there's got to be a better way, well, I found it. Brian Wolfmuller and I found it. Brian thought of it. I said, we got to share this with the world, and you can learn about it. It's called Everbook. Now, bear with me. To find out about it now, you have to go to everbook89751536.wordpress.com. That's not the final website. We'll get there eventually. Having a little trouble getting a hold of everbook.com because somebody owns it, not doing anything with it. But I'll put the link in the show notes below so you can find that there. Or if you just check out my Facebook page, my Twitter feed, you'll be able to find it there as well. Everbook. It is the last journal you will ever need. I'm just a few days away from dropping off the manuscript for my third book to be published with Concordia Publishing House. We're in a little debate about what the title's going to be. But I thought, you know what I don't do? I don't ever tell you enough about Broken and Echo and how I think they're worth reading. So if you've never read them, if you enjoy this show and you've never picked up a copy of Broken or Echo, you should go do that. Go to Amazon.com or cph.org. Amazon.com will save you some money if you got Prime. And I would say start with Echo personally, but it kind of depends on what you're into. If you want pop culture, goofiness, and discernment, that's Broken. If you want to know why your catechism is not a medieval torture device, but in fact one of the most amazing pictures ever drawn by the hand of God, well, then you should check out Echo. Broken and Echo, both by Jonathan Fiske, wherever books are sold online in large numbers. I wish it was wherever books are sold. And if you haven't found the projectresurrection.blog, I know I said no tomorrow before. I'm such a loser. I believe firmly in this publish then filter reality that you try something out and you see if it works, and if it doesn't work, you change it. So things are kind of coming together. But projectresurrection.blog, well, this thing's called Project Resurrection now, and .net sounds really lame, and .com is way too expensive. So projectresurrection.blog, you'll find not only all of the episodes of this podcast, also divided by series, although I'm still working on getting the back issues up in that, you'll also find all the new stuff I'm doing. So the streaming on Facebook of Sharper Iron, that's showing up there. I'm going to be getting Issues Etc. interviews up there. Of course, the sermons will be there, and whether I'll end up starting to write stuff there, I don't know. But if you want to know where I'm doing what I'm doing, you want to follow the teaching that I do for the sake of your faith, projectresurrection.blog is the one you should have bookmarked. Oh, and while I'm at it, I'll just throw this free plug out there. I am not being paid for this, but I just completed a 5-day fast using ProLon. You can find out more about it at ProLonFMD.com. It was incredible. You can do a 5-day water fast, and science has shown not only will it help purge fat cells, particularly off your internal organs, the fat you can't see, which is the stuff that kills you eventually. Not only will it put you into a state of ketosis for at least 3 solid days, and stimulate stem cell genesis. I mean, that's what a fast would do, just a strict water fast, but what ProLon has figured out is how to mimic that fast with a diet. Now, it's gonna cost you a little bit of money, but you're gonna be able to go through a 5-day fast. You'll be hungry, but you'll also get to eat. And the food you eat, it's pretty darn good. I am excited about what just happened. My goal right now is to do this 5-day fast once a month for 3 months, that's your front loading, and then do it once a quarter, well, possibly for the rest of my life. My hope here is to handle some of my cholesterol without going on to cholesterol medication, and that has been shown, at least anecdotally, to happen for some people. That may or may not be your issue, but I've also lost, well, I've lost 5.5 pounds. It was more like 7 pounds in a week. Now, you got to work to keep it off. You can't just go back and pile on the carbs right away, right? But if you want to jumpstart your diet, if you want a chance to reboot your system, I can't speak highly enough. I look forward to doing it again. That's ProLonFMD.com. Hey, and that was a pretty sweet advertisement, wasn't it? So if you got something cool that you would like me to share, why don't you reach out to me, see if you can, you know, get me a free version of whatever it is that it is. I may or may not be able to share it. Depends on if I like it or use it, right? But if you're interested in promoting your stuff here, I'm willing to talk to you about what that would look like. Anyway, you want some Daniel, right? Have you ever looked in the eyes of a homeless man? It's not that easy. because they don't often hold your eye contact for long, or maybe it's that you don't hold their eye contact for long. It's probably a little of both. There's shame involved in the meeting, is there not? Have you ever taken the time to watch a homeless man for more than a few seconds as you drive by, but to actually kind of just sit there and look at who he is and ask the question, how did he get here? Where did he come from? What's his story? What does he need? People who work with those who are homeless are usually pretty clear about the fact that it's a choice and not a choice at the same time. A vast majority of them suffer with some form of mental illness. And golly, don't we live in a time when even saying mental illness sounds politically incorrect, as if we're not allowed to acknowledge sickness? Many of them suffer with a mental illness. We usually wouldn't use the term mad, but, well, maybe we should. They are driven. They are confused. They're often paranoid and afraid. But they're not dumb. They're not mindless, at least not all of them. Some might be. The drugs can do quite a work on your head. But they're there by choice and not by choice. Driven. Maniacal in a certain way. I mean, what else could compel you to not do something about the situation? We live in a country where you can do something about the situation. It's hard. It's not easy. It takes change, personal, internal change, and we all know how tough that is. But the point here is they're there for a variety of reasons. And have you ever stopped to wonder what that is and how maybe you might end up there if it had not been for the grace of God? Because that's what happens to King Nebuchadnezzar. He is the king of the greatest country that there ever has been, so far as God is concerned, the golden head of the statue. And yet, in order to teach him grace, in order to teach him his sinful condition and the need for the forgiveness of sins in the preaching of the Messiah, well, God turns him into a homeless man. But he's not just, you know, it's not just God strips him of his power by some sort of warfare or something. He goes mad. He gets a mental illness. And if you're anything like me, when you first heard this story as a kid, it really kind of blew your mind. You were like, well, that's weird and silly. And then maybe even as an adult, you started to say, well, this just doesn't even sound real. Like I'll do 6-day creation and I'll do the flood. But wait, King Nebuchadnezzar like thought he was a cow for 7 years and his kingdom was cool with it. And he like was on all fours, right? Like he's on hands and knees living out in the field. Everyone's like, well, that's just a king. That's what he does. He'll be back someday. Like that seems a little weird. It's probably not even true, right? It's probably just a story. That's not even real. Although there is this thing called zoanthropy. You can hear in it the word zoo, right? Which I'm pretty sure comes from the word life, zoe in the Greek. And then anthropos, man, right? So animal man. Clinical animal mannery, clinical zoanthropy is a diagnosable mental medical condition. Like unto gender dysphoria, in which somebody believes they are not what they very evidently, to all appearances, scientifically and otherwise, are. I remember seeing a video shortly after the transgender thing became really acceptable just overnight, about what, a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, in which there was a girl on Facebook who insisted she was a dog. And I remember everybody laughing at her. She in the video, she had like ears that she'd put on a headband and stuff, and she was walking around on all fours in her house with her other dog. And I remember people saying, oh, it's just, yeah, look what's happening. People are crazy. Well, this is the thing. People go crazy. It happens. And probably the greatest threat that I think is embedded in the current non-gender dysphoria, but instead transgender celebration, is the question of, are we ever allowed to call mental illness mental illness? How long until we have to tell that girl, yep, you're a dog, out of some sort of what? I don't know. Well, it's always a socialist fascist agenda, if you ask me, but I'm just a conspiracy theorist. We can talk about that all later. I'm not actually a conspiracy theorist, but I don't like socialism. Different story. The thing is, clinical zoanthropy is a real thing. It is a rare delusion in which a person believes himself or herself to be an animal. Now, according to PubMed.gov, which you would think, since it's got a .gov, this is not just some corner, right, corner of the internet, a search was conducted on the classical and scientific literature and found only 56 cases of clinical zoanthropy in international scientific literature. Now, that's a limited time frame that that's being included in, right? That makes it exceedingly rare. 56 cases on the planet in like a 75-year period is exceedingly rare. But it's not impossible, and it's not non-existent. In fact, they even go so far as to say it's probably more common than we realize. Since, I'm quoting now, since specific studies have yielded a relatively large number of cases in the past, this is before kind of modern psychology, it can be concluded that the disorder is probably more prevalent than is suggested in the literature. These cases may well be not only primary types based on mental or unclear clauses, but also secondary types mediated by aberrant somatosensory sensations. Treatment of the underlying condition has proved to be increasingly successful over time. Oh, wait, so you can actually, you can do conversion therapy on the person who thinks they're a dog. But don't try it. Don't try it if you're sexually distracted in any way, right? Whether it's your hedonistic hunger for many women, or your, as a man, hedonistic hunger for many men. No, don't do that then. But if you think you're a dog, we can fix it. The conclusion, because of the possible co-concurrence of zoanthropy and alterations in coenthesis, I don't even know what that is, the sensation, they define it, i.e. the sensation of physical experience, mental health workers should be on the lookout for cases of clinical zoanthropy in clinical practice, and avoid treating them in the same way that they would treat other delusions. All cases that occur should be subjected to extrasomatic investigations, including EEG and neuroimaging. So brain scans, right? They're looking at physical causes for this in the brain. And treatment should be adjusted in accordance with the findings. So what should you take from that? You should take from that that the idea that King Nebuchadnezzar was struck by a mental madness that convinced him that he was a cow or an ox, it's not impossible just strictly from a secular sense. It's quite possible. Now, as to the cause and as to the solution, as to the holding on to power as he did, since this apparently took place for 7 years, well, that's another question to be investigated. But let's just start with this, right? This is not a far-fetched thing in the Bible. This is actually pretty scientifically diagnosable. It's on PubMed.gov. Just put that in your back pocket and feel good about it. And then add this one to your childhood image of like the king in his robes, you know, all tattered down in the grass, like actually acting like a cow. It has also been demonstrated from some of the older literature, as was known in the days of Kyle and Dalich, that a person who experienced insania zoanthropica, as they called it, didn't necessarily always act like the animal in every way, but merely thought they were the animal. So it didn't mean they went on all fours, but it meant that they thought that they were this thing and still had actions like unto it. In some ways, you could even just see it as a complete loss of conscious thought and being driven to animalistic urge. That's the way I'm going to go ahead and imagine what happened to King Nebuchadnezzar. But we maybe need to set this thing up a little bit. And yet, before we do, I really have to address the real liberal attack. How and why this story is attacked in the scriptures beyond just the madness itself. And there are three reasons, and I've mentioned two of them already. The first is, how could it possibly go on for 7 years? It's kind of two combined. How did it go on for 7 years without, number two, Nebuchadnezzar losing the kingdom or destroying the kingdom. I mean, this is the ancient world where kings are conquering kings all the time, and they're always being threatened by those beneath them, right? Sons are killing their fathers to be king, and this guy's mad for 7 years and it's just fine, right? So that's a question. And then the third question is, so even if that all happened, why is there no record of it in extra-biblical sources? As the argument goes, we have all sorts of extra-biblical sources from the ancient world. You would think something of this extreme nature would have been mentioned. Now, those sound like pretty good arguments on the surface. But, well, they're not. So the first thing to say to somebody who says, well, none of the ancient documents mention the madness of Nebuchadnezzar except for your mythological Bible. What you should say is, oh, really? Have you read the ancient documents? I'm just curious if you've actually looked at them. Which ones are you talking about? Because the thing is, well, it's a little complicated, but not only do they mention it, but the issue of there not being very many ancient documents is pretty darn pertinent as well. So let's just take a field trip here. I want you to imagine yourself living in the city of Rome in the late first century, right around the time that Rome is destroying Jerusalem, right? So 70 AD, somewhere around there. I want you to imagine yourself as a man who is he's Jewish by birth, but he's defected. He's become a Roman citizen. He believes in Rome, not in Judaism. And he's worked his way into being the advisor to Titus, who eventually will become the emperor, and who does lead the siege in Jerusalem. This guy's name, who you are imagining yourself to be, is Yosef ben Matityahu. Not Matityahu, right? The rapper? But same namesake, I suppose. Yosef ben Matityahu, who we today normally just refer to as Josephus, or Titus Flavius Josephus, one of the early great historians of world history, particularly in his cataloging of Jewish life, in his books, The Jewish War and Antiquities of the Jews. Now, so you're this guy, and you're a historian, right? You're a professor who advises the emperor. And so you got to study, right? And like today, I think of a study, and there's a desk, there's a computer, there is a bunch of books. Well, you got to kind of go back. There would have been some sort of writing desk and writing utensils, maybe a nice open window for some light. And then there would be some scrolls, probably a lot of scrolls, and then a couple of these new things called books. But see, the only things that were being really put together in books at this time were elements of the New Testament. Books as folded things were more or less invented for the sake of the Bible. So you didn't really have many of those. Maybe you had a copy of the Gospels, though, it made its way to you. It would have been early for that, though, I think, pretty early. So but if you want to imagine the books, they're fine. But there's no Google, and there's no library as you know it. There is a great library in Alexandria with lots and lots of scrolls and lots of information there, but it's not like every area has copies of everything. In fact, copies of stuff is one of the great problems. So just because you write a book in the ancient world on a scroll doesn't mean anybody can read it. It's got to be copied to be read. And just because 5 people read it doesn't mean everyone knows what it is. And maybe the 5 people who read it, they really liked it, and they write about it, and they'll even quote some of what you said, but they don't quote the entire thing. Now imagine that that's been going on like that for what, 1,000 years? Maybe not quite that much, 500, 400 years, papyrus, wherever that comes around. And now here you are, and you're going to attempt to put together a history of any area, forget the Jews for a moment, of any area. And all you have are not original sources, but sources which cite original sources. And you don't have all the ones ever written. You know there are books that were written, and you don't know how to find them. They don't even exist anymore. This is why the destruction of the Library of Alexandria was so bad, because they did have a copy of a lot of stuff. And who knows, maybe Josephus went down there and made a trip. But this really illustrates the challenge of how we know what we know about the ancient world. It wasn't like you just had a new history book published every year with all the information in it, and you had copies of everything that was cited. So when you make the claim that none of the ancient documents regarding Babylon mention this, well, here's the thing. of the actual six documents that we have that talk about the time period of the life of Nebuchadnezzar, not a single one is the kind of work that you would expect to find information about his disease the way you find it described in the scriptures. The actual ancient documents that we have with regard to this time period at this place are quite rare. So much so that Herodotus, whose name you may not know, but this guy, if you did any history or philosophy in college, you should remember this guy's name. Herodotus is the father of history. Like, he's the first guy who really starts doing it the way we think of it. Taking sources, compiling sources. He doesn't do all the criticism the way that we do today, you know, questioning the sources, but he's the father of it. Herodotus, who writes a world history, doesn't know who Nebuchadnezzar is. Doesn't know his name. So, I mean, that says something there, right? It's not as if there was just pamphlets lying around on every street describing the reign of King Nebuchadnezzar. This doesn't mean that Nebuchadnezzar's life was not important to the ancient world. Just because Herodotus doesn't know about his victory over the Egyptians at Carchemish, right, and the shifting of all that, it doesn't mean it wasn't important. But it does mean that to expect that we would just have, you know, encyclopedic knowledge of the time from any of the documents is silly. I mean, have you read the documents? Do you know what we actually have? So again, Josephus names six authors whose works make mention of Nebuchadnezzar. And four of these authors speak only incidentally of him at all. And as an example, he only gives one of them, Philostratus, who wrote the Annals of the Phoenicians and another work, Megasthenes and Diocles. The first one's a Phoenician history. The other two are histories of Persia, but they only incidentally mention Nebuchadnezzar at all. That is, he only gets a line in the book. There's not time for a biography. So beyond the other three authors who are just like this guy, there's only these two guys, Berosus and Abidinus, who have recorded Chaldean history. Berosus was a priest of Belus at Babylon in the time of Alexander the Great, and he examined many ancient documents and is acknowledged by most to be a fairly trustworthy historian. But we don't have his work. We only have certain broken scraps. We have fragments of his work, and they are not actual fragments. We don't have the paper. We just have the quotes in Josephus and Eusebius and later authors who are probably using Josephus and Eusebius as their source. So the only actual copy of what we have is what Josephus says. It's not even the entire book. And it would seem that Josephus doesn't have the original either. He's using a work by Alexander Polyhistor, who is a contemporary of Sulla. So you're looking during the fall of the Roman Republic before the empire gives rise. So 100 years, 150 years, 200 years prior, a book from then he's quoting, and that book was quoting the original source. And the thing with that is that this guy who he's quoting is not known to be a particularly accurate historian. He's one of those guys who more makes up stories and puts them tells the story the way it ought to be told, like me. You please do not consider me a historian, as I'm kind of helping you imagine, trying to get you into what the reality is. But if I were doing this bit about Josephus and his study and say, well, that's exactly how it was, right? That's a little more the way the history was done in the early Roman Republic. And then you have this guy, Abidinus, who lived after Josephus. So he was even further removed from any original resources. And the mere fragments we have of his work is only what's preserved by Eusebius, right? So you're really stuck with Josephus and Eusebius as your actual physical sources of information. And within them, you only have scraps of works. So unless they intentionally were going to talk about the madness of King Nebuchadnezzar, there's no reason for them to bring this up or for this to be where it was. And yet, it would seem that in the parts that Josephus does have, he has preserved a notice from Berosus, this author of Chaldean Babylonian history, that mentions Nebuchadnezzar having an unusual malady at some point before he died. It says, Nebuchadnezzar, after he had begun to build the forementioned wall, fell sick and departed this life when he had reigned 43 years. Now, if you're going to read this like an American, then you're like, oh, it's one sentence. He's building the wall and he finishes, then he gets sick and dies. But see, you're dealing with ancient history and the expense of paper. And the word "and" is a period and sometimes even a paragraph in which, like, years and years go by. So I could say something like this: George Washington fought the Revolutionary War and crossed the Tiber River, then retired to his home in Virginia and died. And you'd be like, wow, that all happened in a week? No, it didn't happen in a week. I'm just listing off like the key moments in his life that you need to remember. He served as president. I should have thrown that one in there, right? But key moments in his life, you're just listing it off. You almost want to think that this is bullet points. So the bullet points that are given about Nebuchadnezzar in Bosporus are this: that he built a major wall, that he had an unusual malady, and then eventually he died, right? That's it. And someone takes his place. Read it like it's a genealogy and not like it's a fiction novel. There was this guy, Nebuchadnezzar, and in the latter half of his life, the three things you got to know about him is this: he completed a wall, something weird happened to him, he had a bizarre disease, and then eventually his kingdom, you know, was passed to another. That's all you got to know. So then, if that isn't enough for you, right? Have you ever read the documents? Abdenis, this other guy who's preserved in Eusebius, again by quotes, talks of, in an extended section, Nebuchadnezzar, after ending the war that he had in the West, mounted his royal tower and was seized by some god, right? Kataskelethane theoateodei. And he announced to the Babylonians their inevitable subjugation to the Medes, who would then be helped by their own gods. And he prayed that the Persians would be destroyed in the abyss of the sea. But he wished for himself a peaceful death rather than to see the fall of the Chaldean Empire. And immediately after this utterance, he was snatched away from the sight of men. That's the ancient document, right? So I mean, we'll try to put this together at the end, but you know, he's standing on his roof and he gets struck by the madness, but he's a prophet for a moment and he just proclaims this and all his counselors are like, what? And then he like shambles off out of the castle to go live like an ox for a little while. Now, the ox part's not mentioned, but don't tell me that there's nothing of it in the ancient documents. Yeah, just because you don't believe it. In fact, I love this. This is the best. There is a contemporary to Kylan Dalich who they refer to as Hitz, H-I-T-Z. They're abbreviating it, so I don't know his name. I'm not going to go look it up. But he's always like their counterpoint. He's their foremost liberal critical scholar who doesn't believe anything, right? So whenever they're quoting him, they're quoting like the guy who's trying not to believe what the Bible says. And so here's what Hitz says of the piece from Abidinus, right? The history in Eusebius, quoted by Eusebius from Abidinus. He says, "The statement sounds so fabulous that no historical substance can be discovered in it." Okay, so what does that mean? It means that he goes like this. He says, "There is no evidence in any of the ancient documents about this happening to Nebuchadnezzar." And you're like, yeah, but what about that one of the six who mentions it happening really in detail? Well, that one doesn't count. That one can't possibly be real. We can't count that one. Okay, so which ancient documents am I allowed to use in your argument? Which ones are you using, right? It's hilarious. "I won't believe a god unless you make a proof for God." I'm like, well, look at the creation. It got made. It's here. How to get here? Well, that doesn't count. You got to prove God exists without using anything in creation to do it. Well, you know, at a certain point, you're just obstructing reality. Yeah. You're just bigoted. You just got a priori assumptions that you don't want to deal with. So now the other two liberal, critical, skeptical questions, right, are the length of time that Nebuchadnezzar would have not been king, and what happened to the government during that time. And I'm going to start off by telling you that these are easy. A lot of times the answers are easy if you're just not looking for an excuse not to believe. So in verse 24 of chapter 4 of Daniel, Daniel says to Nebuchadnezzar, "You shall be driven from among men, and your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. You shall be made to eat grass like the ox, and you shall be wet with the dew of heaven. And 7 periods of time shall pass over you until you know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to them to whom he will." So what's actually mentioned in the text is not 7 years. It's 7 periods of time. And while it is true that there are, wink, wink, times where we will understand the Bible's use of the word in that way to mean a year, there are also times when we don't understand it that way. So in Daniel 7:25, speaking of the fourth beast, it is said that he shall speak words against the Most High and shall wear out the saints of the Most High and shall think to change the times and the law. And they shall be given into his hand for a time, times, and half a time. Now, very few interpreters ever have considered that to be a year, 2 years, and half a year, right? It means something quite different. We'll get there when we get there. I'll give it to you now. It means the right amount of time. We can't know what it is. We're not told what it is. It means the right amount of time. Now, I don't think that seven periods of time, back in chapter 4, necessarily just means some random number, although it could, because the number 7 is pretty significant, right? That's the more important thing here, is that there is a holiness to what's going on here. This gets to the madness of Nebuchadnezzar in his unbelief and his restoration, his redemption through this process, that God is actually going to speak to him in such a way that he will acknowledge God for who he is. But with that being said, if you want to have it be 7 actual periods of specific time, I'm kind of with you, I'm on that, but you're not limited to years. It could be months, it could be weeks, it could be days. Technically, it could be hours, although that's probably unlikely, because I don't think that his response would be quite the same after 7 hours, but then again, maybe it would. So for my own head, I like days here. Because now this gets to, how did the government survive without him? Well, again, this isn't that hard. The government survived without him because he had loyal counselors who took over the government. They actually liked him as their king. They liked the way things were running. It wasn't going to help the kingdom to have him not be there. Who knows? His son was too young. They didn't want the power. Maybe it was Daniel. You ever think about that? This guy was like the sorcerer supreme, head of the Magi. And the Magi were counselors and rulers. And so how do you know that Daniel didn't actually hide him this entire time? So that he has this strange malady that the history doesn't really know about. No one really knows what it means, but he was just in seclusion for that time. You don't know that, do you? Right. So it could have been. And so Daniel hides him for what? 7 months? 7 weeks? 7 days? Now, I don't know if Daniel actually hid him, right? In fact, I'm gonna treat my imagination as though he didn't, but I am going to have Daniel being involved in the leadership of the country while Nebuchadnezzar is mad for, I'm going to say, a week. Now, if you want months, that's fine. But a week, this certainly answers the question of how the government survived and how it didn't destroy everything. I mean, the king vanished for a week. Do you remember the story of, it's not the prince and the pauper, but of the king who decides to dress up like a poor man and go down among his city in the evening and walk and pretend to be poor and listen to his people? He would beg to try to get a grasp on his kingdom. Now, he'd only do that for a night, but if he did that for a week, and what would that look like? What would that do? Because that's sort of what this is, only without the benevolence of the king at this point. It is the story of the king who became a homeless man for a week. Now, there are two other small skeptical complaints that I want to just throw you the answers to before we go into the story proper. And one is that this can't be true because in Nebuchadnezzar's proclamations, you have language and words that basically come straight out of the Psalms and out of Isaiah. And so it's impossible for him to do that. Okay, so you're denying, prophecy as conduit, fine. But you're also denying Daniel's proximity to the guy, right? I'm not saying that he was studying Isaiah all the time, but maybe when he came back into it, like Daniel's feeding him soup, and the king's like, I got to make a proclamation. He's like, I want to say this, but how would you say that? How would you say that about your God? And Daniel's like, he just pulls a verse out of Isaiah, pulls a psalm out, right? So it's not a very good argument really at all. And then you have the argument that, well, in the ancient world and today too, what leader or ruler would publish as a proclamation a demonstration of their own failings, of their own madness? Nobody would do that. It would ruin them as a politician, as a king, and so they wouldn't do that. So therefore, this can't be true. And again, like you're denying the central point of the entire thing, that he's been brought to faith. You ever talk to somebody who's been converted to Christianity recently? They don't care they'll talk about their past. They're not hiding nothing. They're like, you know what I used to be? And I'm not now. And God did it. right? Like that's exactly what Nebuchadnezzar does. Which I'll throw this out here too. It's crazy that Calvin, by the end of this thing, Calvin thinks he's not converted. But this is the whole point of this thing. It's centered. It's chiasm centered in the bit about how God is judging the nations, right? That God is dealing with the world power of the nations and not letting them stand on their own. In the middle of that is a story about a king who is shown the true God and understands that all things come from him. And you want to say he wasn't actually converted? God got that far but didn't predestine him, Calvin? What are you talking about? Oh, and don't miss the death and resurrection motif. We'll see if we can fit that in at the end here. How at the center of the world power is a king who for a time is taken away, but then again is restored, right? Maybe the seven times was 3 days. Yeah? Yeah? You with me? All right. Well, that's quite a prologue. How much time we got left? Not much. Not enough. We'll get there. You ready? So you're king of Babylon. And this is like 15 years after the fiery furnace deal, right? So we just jump there in the text, but it's like 15 years later, maybe 20 years after Daniel had explained the first dream to him about the statue. So it's been quite a while and things have gone really good. You've in fact established peace. You don't have enemies at the moment. You are dwelling in prosperity and your kingdom is in prosperity, just as the golden head foretold. Now, whether you remember that, you certainly aren't only attributing it to the true God at this point. In fact, you're attributing it to yourself and your own greatness that's going to come out. But you're doing pretty good. You got the mansion. You got the palace with the massive rooftops, you know, with the wet bar and, you know, the pool tables outside in a beautiful Mediterranean breeze, right? Things are going pretty good. You go to bed. The curtains are blowing again with the wind. It's just so nice. You're one of your wives, perhaps, is you know, resting gently against you, and you drift off to sleep. And oh no, you have another dream. And in this dream, you see a marvelous tree. It's huge. It is reaching out with these vast, beautiful branches, and there's this gorgeous fruit hanging from it. And underneath it are animals of every kind. And in it are birds of every kind. They find rest and comfort in this tree. It's very surreal, right? Very, very pastoral. Green grass everywhere, blue sky. It's the way life ought to be. Maybe the lion is even laying down with the lamb right there, right? And then the sky rips in half, and out of it, from some sort of void of lightning and fire beyond, comes this being of monstrous, terrifying strength, wrapped in armor, covered in eyes, and speaking with a loud voice, "Chop down the tree and lop off its branches, strip its leaves bare and scatter its fruit. The beast shall flee, the birds shall fly away, but leave the stump and bind it with iron and bronze. Amid the tender grass, let it become wet with the dew of heaven, and its portion ever be with the beasts. Let his mind be changed from a man's to a beast's, and let seven periods of time pass over him. The sentence is by the decree of the watchers, the decision by the word of the holy ones, to the end that the living may know that the Most High rules the kingdoms of men and gives it to whom he will, and shall set over it the lowliest of men." And bam, poof, you're awake, sweating in your sheets, right? Your wife's sitting there, and she doesn't even know what just happened, right? But you're just like, you are absolutely, absolutely flabbergasted, beyond understanding. You don't even know what to know about this, right? That was too real. That was too scary. What on earth is going on? And you're like, well, here's the thing. Some of the commenters are like, he doesn't remember the last dream. I'm like, this has happened once before. I don't think he forgot. But then you have an interesting situation. What he does is he immediately calls all of the wise men of Babylon. Now, this sounds familiar, right? The magicians, the enchanters, the Chaldeans, the astronomers, they all come in. And this time he doesn't demand that they tell him the dream. He tells them the dream. And they're like, Don't know, king, not sure. Now, well, maybe there's a reason why, because it wasn't like this one was quite as hard to figure out, right? But who wants to tell the king that, like, the gods just told him he's screwed, right? So, you know, forgive my French, but who wants to tell the king that? And so at last, Daniel comes in, who the text says, Daniel, who is named Belteshazzar after the name of my God. So the king is calling him this at this point. Remember, Belteshazzar, or Belteshazzar, however you want to say it, means God save the king. That's actually Daniel's, his name, right? And the issue is, well, why didn't he call Daniel first? And you have a couple of answers that are given. Kyle and Dalich actually say, because he forgot. He forgot about Daniel, the Sorcerer Supreme, who he'd put over all of his magi and magicians, who had given him the interpretation of the vision that no one else could do before, and he said had the power of gods, whose friends came out of the fire. He forgot. Now, I love Kyle and Dalich. They are so valuable, but really, guys, really. So I like this answer a little bit more. I think Nebuchadnezzar knows what the dream means. I think he knows exactly what the dream means. And he doesn't want any prophet to confirm it. So he's a little bit like Balak, the son of Zippor, who had seen all that Israel in their warfare had done to the Amorites, and had all of his Moabites in great dread and overcome with fear, lest they have to go to do battle with a country that had an actual god fighting on their side. And he says, this horde will lick up all that surrounds us as the ox licks up the grass of the field. And so he goes and sends for Balaam, the son of Beor at Pethor. And he says, behold, this people's come out of Egypt, they cover the face of the earth. Come now, curse this people for me, since they are too mighty for me. Perhaps I will be able to defeat them. Now, you remember the story, right? Balaam isn't supposed to go. There's the donkey, all that stuff. But he gets there, and he's told, he's being paid as a prophet to curse Israel. And then out of his mouth comes truth. Israel shall destroy you, right? And this happens three times. It's like, I'm a prophet. I don't get to tell God what to, I say. It's not like I say it, and then God has to do it. But see, that's how people treated it. When you're dealing with paganism, it is all about bartering with the gods. It is all about getting the gods to say the right thing. And so I want to get the right magister, the right magician, to come and tell me something different, right? These guys love me. They want what's good for me. So they can, like, flex their elbow grease with God and give me a different message. Or at the very least, I know they'll lie to me. I know they'll tell me something that I want to hear. So this is just it. He is still in his flesh, right? He doesn't want to hear the truth, and so he doesn't call Daniel. But they're all too afraid to tell him, because it's like the dream is so obvious. It's so clear what's going on. And I kind of went fast with it. If you go back, you look at the text, it's very clear what's going on. So finally he's like, oh, gosh darn it. I got to summon Daniel. I don't want to summon Daniel. Daniel's going to tell me it's about me, and I'm going to go crazy and lose everything. This will just be awful. Okay, fine, go. Go get Daniel. And Daniel comes in before him. And he says to Daniel, Hey, God save the king. Remember, that's your name. God save the king. Hey, God save the king. Sorcerer Supreme. I know that the spirit of the holy gods dwells in you, and that there's no mystery too difficult for you. So tell me the vision of my head and my dream and its interpretation. Now here, I'll tell you what it all is. But could you please tell me what it means? And you can see him kind of grimace and just hold his breath. And it's got to be even worse because of what happens next with Daniel. So Daniel, we're in verse 19 if you want to go check that out. Daniel, whose name was God Save the King. Now, so why does it say that? It's already said it several times. Why does it say it now? Daniel loves the king. He is not forgotten by the king. Daniel works with the king all the time. These guys are friends, right? Daniel loves the king. And the look on Daniel's face as soon as the king is done telling him the dream is so abhorrent and terrified that the king knows immediately this is not a good thing. He can tell just by the grimace and the eyebrow furrow on Daniel's face that something's wrong. And he pipes up. He says, God save the king, Belteshazzar. Look, man, don't let what it means stop you from telling me what it means. And then Daniel says these enigmatic words here. You can take this in one of two ways. He says, "My Lord, may the dream be for those who hate you and its interpretation for your enemies." And I'm not entirely confident which one of these I want to cling to. So one of them is that he's saying, King, I would rather tell this to your enemies than to you, right? And the other one is, King, this is what your enemies would like to see me say to you. I think I have to go with the first one. That's what Kyle and Dalich do. But and they're kind of connected to each other, I suppose, right? This is what your enemies would wish, but I would rather say this to your enemies than you. I mean, I don't think Daniel's just trying to save his skin, but I think, you know, in this relationship that they have, which I believe is firmly there, it's very established in the undercurrent of the text that they work together. He's like, sure, I'm going to tell you this, but I would rather that this were something I said about your enemies. This is what I would like to prophesy this about those who hate you. But all right, fine, here we go. The tree that you saw, that's top reached to the heavens, that was visible over all the earth, that's leaves were fruitful and abundant, this is you. Now, big difference between the statue and the tree, right? The statue was the kingdom. This isn't dealing with the kingdom of the world anymore. We're actually boiling it down to one man. All men reduced to one man. It is you, O King, who have grown and become strong. Your greatness has grown and reaches to heaven, and your dominion is to the ends of the earth. Now, some, you know, really skeptical modern person might be like, well, it didn't really have dominion to the ends of the earth. Yeah, no, but so far as they understood it, they did. Everyone talked this way back then, and this is not an error. This is their perspective. This is how they see it. He was the king of all that he could see, and the tree symbolized that. But this watcher, and this is a strange word, right? It's an angel of some kind, a holy one, a being out of heaven. Some scholars think that this is connected to Babylonian religion, so it's kind of veiled in Babylonian imagery. But there certainly is a biblical idea that both angels and demons don't sleep, that they're always awake, they're always seen, and that particularly the angels are set to watch over the kingdom of God, over the people that are in the covenant, over the creation as well, right? So this angelic but Babylonian-looking armor beast, I don't know what to call him, this guard, this sentinel, this keeper, this witness, he decrees on behalf of the Most High, one and only true God, that which is about to come upon you, my Lord the King, that you shall be driven from among men and dwell with the beasts of the field. You will eat grass, you're going to sleep in the rain, and a holy period of time shall pass over you. And my king, listen carefully. This is so that you may know that the Most High God rules over all the kingdoms of men and gives them to whom he will. My king, this is so that you would know what you should know by now, that my God is the only true God, that there are no other gods, and that you have not made yourself who you are, but he has made you who you are, and he would have you know and worship him. Let my counsel be acceptable to you if you break off your unbelief now, if you practice the righteousness of the word which I can give to you now, if you divorce yourself from the pursuit of proud iniquity and instead show mercy, become a preacher to those oppressed by false teaching, there can be a lengthening of your prosperity. It doesn't have to come to pass. Repent and believe the gospel. But if you will not, you got to know that this decree will be like chains of brass and iron wrapped around you. The stump of yourself will be unable to escape from what is about to come upon you. Now, we don't know at all what happened next, because we like jump a year, 12 months. It's very clear, right? At the end of 12 months, Nebuchadnezzar was walking upon the roof of the royal palace. This all came upon him at that time. But why 12 months? Was it to the day? Probably not. Had he forgotten about it? it would seem so. Because, you know, God is not slow in keeping his promises, as some people count slowness, but a lot of people count slowness in such a way to think that God is slow in keeping his promises. A day is like 1,000 years. Okay, it's all going to come upon you soon. There was a year for him to repent. That's the point. But he didn't. Otherwise, it wouldn't have happened. So we just skip past that. We don't go into his humiliation of his unrepentance here. He simply jumps to the fact that, obviously I didn't repent, because at the end of 12 months, Nebuchadnezzar was walking on the roof of the royal palace, right? He's got his spread there. He's got the benches and the tables and like the waitresses bringing him margaritas. And he's looking out over Babylon. It had to be spectacular. If you've ever been at a high point at a city where you can see the whole city spreading out, you know, like that, had to be spectacular. Fine restaurant looking out over what? New York? Athens? And so he's looking and he says to himself, is this not Babylon the Great? Is this not Babylon the Great, whom I have built by my power and my royal residency and for the glory of displaying my majesty? Now, don't miss how John in Revelation picks up on Babylon the Great. That comes up, right? And maybe we'll revisit this at that point. Babylon has fallen. Oh, I love it. That's a different story, right? Here it is, Nebuchadnezzar has fallen, and he's fallen by thinking that Babylon is great. And while those words are in his mouth, there falls a voice out of the cracked sky of heaven. A voice like the sound of many waters says, Nebuchadnezzar, unto you this day, thus saith the Lord, the kingdom is wrenched from you. Obsession and paranoia shall torment you until you no longer know the life of men. But you shall bestial be wrought, like an ox, like a swine, until the holy times are completed and you believe that I am the Lord, that I reign the realms of men and give the age to him whom I shall choose. And not a moment passes, but that this begins. Now, we got kind of three pieces here. We got the potential that he literally prophesied at this moment too, right? That he kind of went straight conduit from God and spoke about the oncoming destruction of the kingdom after him to the Persians. So that if that happened, I mean, everyone there is going to be like, wait, what? The king was just sipping on the margaritas and now he's calling out the end of the kingdom. Now, maybe that didn't happen. Maybe it did. Maybe he just looked around at everybody with utter paranoia and began to just kind of mumble and chew on his lip and kind of be driven to leave as fast as he can. And he gets up and he wraps his robes around himself and he's just kind of like, what is it, my king? And he just kind of backs away and wanders off and heads off down the hallway. Now, the other thing is, I like this. Please don't take this as the word of God, but I like this. How did the madness work? We've talked about the clinical zoanthropy in which the mind is driven to literally believe you're an animal and is demonstrable by discussion and testing. But what about this? What if he was indeed not only aware of his own absolute destruction in this moment, but the destruction of his kingdom that he prophesies? So can you imagine having everything you've ever done turned to dust before your eyes? Like, death is kind of a soft, nice thing. Imagine watching it all slowly disintegrate in like fire and ash. So at the end of your life, when you've just thought, God, you know, I've lived a good life, all the wrong is revealed in an instant to you. And your future in the fires of hell, like you can see a picture of yourself as who you're going to be in eternal torment in your pride and unholiness. And that's all shown to you in an instant. Who is to say it would not make you so despairing, so complexly and overwroughtly destroyed in the mind that you could not speak or think, but simply did the exact same action? You stood up, looked at everybody, just didn't even know what was going on. And like this vision tormenting you, it's staying there, right? So you know how the Scarecrow in the Batman movies, like he puts the gas on your face and you don't really see him. You see like this thing with cockroaches crawling out of his mouth and all that, right? So everywhere you look, there is a picture of the destruction. You look out over the city and it's burning. You look at your daughter and she's dead in a grave, right? All this is going on and you can't get away from it. And so you are driven and you go down the hallway and everyone's like, where is he going? Come back, my king. And he goes so quickly that he gets out of the building and vanishes, right? He's out on the streets walking around in his robe, right? But where to go? Now the question is, did his counselors grab him or not? Did they? But the thing is, how was he eating grass like the ox? Like he's sitting there in his room, like commanding, "Bring me the grass to eat today, so I can continue my madness." Like if the counselors had him in a bedroom, they'd have him chained down. So I think he actually got out. He got away before they knew what was going on, and he wanders off for the holy period of time. So we're back where we began. You walk past this homeless man on the street, you know, coming down out of the hills a little bit, right? Who is that guy? His clothes look pretty ragged and torn. Is it 7 months? If it's 7 months, his robes would be ragged and torn. How fast did he, in fact, hide and grab different clothing? Did he rip his clothing off as he ran out into the fields, trying to get away from civilization? He gets all the way outside the city, right? And there he is, day and night, in torment and utter insanity. It's not just I'm a happy cow. He's lying in the muck with the destruction of himself and the world in his mind. And the rain falls on his face and he doesn't notice. And he wakes with the dew covering him and he rolls over and he just kind of puts his face in the ground and takes a bite. What is there to live for? What is there to know? This is too much for a man to bear. And you know what? I got to say, it's not 7 days. I'm corrected by the text in front of me. It was long enough, so I'm going to go with holy time. We're going to say 2 months. Why not? It doesn't matter. It's the holy time. It's the right amount of time. During this time, his hair grew as long as eagle's feathers. So how long does it take for your hair to grow to your shoulders, right? Not 7 years. and his nails were like bird's claws, right? So he becomes just an utter, utter transient vagabond, lying in the muck with his mind gone. We should probably affirm him and start a people group on Twitter to like give him support and stuff. That was really rude of me. But really, right? Is there no room in our society today for people to actually be hurt? For people to actually have something that needs to be fixed? What fixes Nebuchadnezzar, and I apologize if that offended you, but I hope it makes the point too. He didn't need to be affirmed. He needed to be helped. And on that, his counselors are searching for him. They are looking for him. They don't know where he is. Oh, so who takes over the kingdom now, right? Well, can you imagine Daniel sitting in his study? He's like, hey, someone comes in. Daniel, Belteshazzar, the king, like he just got up and shouted all these words about the end of the kingdom and then wandered off and we can't find him. Daniel knows exactly what's going on. He explained the dream to him. So imagine how Daniel goes straight to what? Who else would be managing, you know, the hand of the king, kind of managing day-to-day affairs? Because that wasn't quite what Daniel was doing, but it was close, right? He would have worked with this guy all the time. And he's like, look, I know what's going on. And I know it's possible that it gets restored. We got to go ahead and make sure everything keeps going the way it should. And we need to be out looking for him right now to try to find him and bring him back. Although we probably won't be able to, but we should be ready for when he's ready to be brought back. Right, so Daniel gets his hands in this. Maybe he doesn't. I think he does. I don't think there's any way he doesn't. It doesn't make any sense. He knows what's going on, and he's got a position of power. So you know, the kingdom's not the issue at the moment, but they are. You know, the guards of Babylon are out searching for the king, looking in homeless shelters, right? Looking in alleyways and gutters, and looking in fields. And maybe they saw him with the long hair and the fingernails, and they couldn't tell. But at the end of the days. Days, there it says. How many? We don't know. How many days? At the end of the days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven, and my reason returned to me. And I blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever. Now, there are a number of Bible verses that come to mind for me at this moment. Like, what happened? What happened to him in his madness? If you conceive of the madness not as strictly, I thought I was a cow, and instead as the despair of seeing everything that he cared about destroyed, driving him to flee from the existence that he knew because he didn't even know how to handle so much pain and destruction, and so he's living like an animal without actually thinking he's an animal. I mean, he could have thought he was an animal, but I don't know if the text has actually compelled us to have to believe that, or maybe they're combined, right? I might as well be an animal. in the midst of this, somehow his brain is there enough for him to come to a conclusion. You know, the Buddha was supposed to sit on a hill for however many days until he became enlightened, right? Buddhism has some wisdom to it. I don't know if I buy the story. He didn't eat for like forever, like 49 days he sits under the tree and he's supposed to be thinking the whole time. And people have trouble with Christ and the 40-day fast, right? And then like there's like, oh, Buddha did it for 49 days. They didn't even question it. Anyway, interestingly, seven times, if it's weeks, would be 49 days until he comes to enlightenment. You ever think Nebuchadnezzar might actually be the Buddha and that Buddhism is just perverted who he actually was? I don't even know what to make of that thought. But what I think is the wisdom that he discovered in this moment is twofold. It's that all flesh is like grass and all its glory like the flowers of the field. The grass withers, the flowers fade, but the word of the Lord endures forever. And vanity of vanity, all is vanity. So it is good to eat your meal and work with your hands and love your wife and raise your kids and let God be the one who handles tomorrow and forever. I think that's what he got. He got that his kingdom was a kingdom of sand, and he knew he needed the foundation of a rock to build his actual person upon. And so he blessed God in this and praised him with, again, words that Daniel no doubt helped him pen in this proclamation. His dominion is an everlasting dominion. His kingdom endures generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing. And he does according to his will among the host of heaven. And none can stay his hand or say to him, what have you done? And in this, he understood. He was enlightened. He was enlightened to believe that the glory is that of the reign of the Holy One of Israel. And when he believed that, not only did his mind return, right? So he gets up and he wanders back into town. And he's thinking clearly. I mean, he knows exactly what's happening. It doesn't matter to him now. Am I king? Am I not king? It doesn't matter. I should probably trim my fingernails. Got to get a job now, I suppose. But it's all right. It's all right because I know, well, I know my Redeemer lives. I know who the real God is. And his counselors find him. After 7 years, they're not looking for him. I'm sorry. But they find him. After 7 months? Sure. After 7 weeks? Yeah, absolutely. So they find him. And they hustle him inside. And they establish him in the kingdom again. They put him right back in charge. Everything's gone on like it's supposed to. There was no coup. There was no attack. And even more greatness was added to him so that the tree becomes greater than it was before. It extends even further. And now I, Nebuchadnezzar, in this Daniel chapter 4, records it for posterity now. I send this out as a proclamation to the edges of my empire to praise and extol and honor the King of Heaven, for all his works are just and all his ways are right. And those who walk in pride, he humbles. It's just what James says. Humble thyself in the sight of the Lord, and he will lift you up. And there is the sanity of Nebuchadnezzar. His madness was his pride and his disbelief, and the clarity of his knowledge of the Holy One as given to him by the preaching of his friend, compatriot, and good worker Daniel. Well, that was his sanity, his salvation, his renewed mind. I'm going to say Calvin was darn wrong on this one. Nebuchadnezzar was a Christian emperor and king, the head of one of the greatest empires that ever was because of its peace, its prosperity, and its faith. His faith. Not everyone converted. His faith made him gold. And in this, he was also, in the book of Daniel, at the center of the first section, which is about God not letting the kingdoms of the world have any say over his plan to save his people and to be the God of those kingdoms as well. In the midst of that, he is the story of mankind. Mankind in the garden, the beautiful tree, who by our pride cast ourselves out and have the tree lopped off. The story of Israel, the nation whom God called and chose and put his name among, that as a beautiful cedar of Lebanon had indeed grown to such an extent that the world was going to be saved through them and brought back through them. And yet, in their unbelief, they are also cut off, and but a stump is left of the house of Jesse. And yet, that little netzer, that little branch, that twig that grows up and becomes an even greater tree than was before? The story of Jesus of Nazareth, son of David, born of the Virgin, suffered, died, buried. Into the madness of our sin, he became sin. Into the insanity of our curse, he became a curse for us. Into the animal nature of our original sinful condition, he bore our iniquities on the tree. And he rose on that third day, majesty and splendor returning to him, not only for his own body, but also for all of Israel, and not only for all of Israel, but also for all of the nations and all of creation also. I'm not saying Nebuchadnezzar understood it with that kind of clarity, that is a New Testament clarity, but I'm saying that he lived it, and I'm saying that his sanity is the sanity of knowing that God is judging with words of promise and salvation, which from of old he looked forward to, we now look back through Christ crucified for us.
Was that worth a dollar? What about five? If so, Rev Fisk and his family would love to have it. Head over to projectresurrection.blog or click the Patreon link in the show notes below if you think the laborer is worth his wages.